supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we're getting more and more emails about Bermuda grass, a wanted turf grass down south, moving into areas in the north where it typically could not survive in previous years. Our lawn care expert, Nick Christians, has an amazing reason for why this is happening, and we'll reveal that reason when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a fabulous phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicating questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Brenda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Brenda. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Brenda great?
I am in Norman, Oklahoma.
Storm in Norman, right next to Oklahoma City. Always,
that's right.
Always great to hear from our old friends down there. What can we do for Brenda in Oklahoma?
Well, I have got a home that faces the west, and I have got two huge 50-year-old pin oaks in my front yard. And over the years, we've owned this house for about 17, 18 years now, and the grass has gradually died. And I have tried planting shade grass underneath it, and it just doesn't seem to want to live. Actually, nothing wants to live under these oak trees. And I'm just wondering if you had a suggestion of what I could do.
Well, you know, in nature, this is how it works, Brenda. When trees are young and their canopy is not full, sometimes you can get some scrubby grasses and little green plants that are surviving within their drip line. But once the trees mature, and homeowners always latch on to the shade as the reason for failure of lawns underneath these big trees. And shade, of course, is a contributing factor. No lawn grass, even the finest fescue, can survive with, I think it's about 4 hours of sun a day. But a more limiting factor is often the ginormous root system of,
yeah,
of these big trees, especially in a climate like yours, which can get famously dry. In the summertime, these trees are always going to have first crack at any water and nutrients, and very often it's not the shade that kills the grass, it's these big bullies stealing their lunch every day, their lunch and their liquids.
And I will say the roots are fairly close to the surface of these trees.
Well,
and these trees are huge.
Right, and they're shading your house, and they're probably breaking that hideous wind that you folks have to deal with.
You are exactly right.
What concerns me is how dry your region can get in the summertime and the competition from the root system of these trees. Now, I will tell you that if the soil has eroded over the years, if you've lost soil, which would not be untypical for Oklahoma, for soil to blow away over time or just reduce in size, you could get a big load of topsoil as long as you didn't cover the root flare of the tree. What I have found to work really well in my own very shady garden is hostas. It is very easy to grow clumps of them and designs of them so that they accent the trees. They put some stuff in the yard. They're not leaving the soil bare. And there are a beautiful variegated varieties now. It's not just the dirt simple, you know, regular dark green hostas. You can get all sorts
right.
of green and white variegated ones. And if there is enough sun in there, you would even get flowers from the hostas. You need really drought-resistant plants. And then in the areas in between the plants and the trees, I think you're a candidate for a nice, you know, non-crazy little bit of mulch. But I believe you have access to pecan hull mulch down there, pine straw, pine fines. I'm seeing all these alternative mulches. Were it I, and plant selection is not my best thing, I would fill the area with hostas and then mulch around the hostas to make it a complete kind of environment.
Okay.
I like the I can visualize your landscape, and I love the dark green of the hostas and some light greens accenting the trees with a nice non-wood mulch.
Okay, that sounds great.
All right. Well, good for you, Brenda. Thank you for not considering taking down those trees. They're saving your life, and you stay cool this summer.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Matt, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Matt. Where are you, man?
At Laurel, Maryland.
Okay, very good. Is that a suburb of D.C., kind of?
It is, yeah, about 20 minutes north.
Okay, what can we do for Matt in Maryland?
I've been collecting the water that drains out of my spin bin composter. I have about 8 gallons of it now. And,
really?
I guess it's technically not really compost tea, but I've been collecting it and been thinking about using it maybe as a nutrient boost for some plants I just planted, or maybe just a couple of weeks ago I reseeded a couple of patches of my lawn with tall fescue grass. And I was wondering if you had any tips for, you know, using that, whether it might be like before or after a rainfall or something like that.
Well, the grass is going to die, Matt.
The
only time you can successfully reseed fescue would be towards the end of August, beginning of September.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
Yeah, it's a cool season grass. That's just going to burn up as soon as it sprouts. So don't waste any time or money on that.
Okay.
Now, this, quote, spin bin composter, this is something on a stand that you turn and it has a spigot at the bottom?
Yes.
What has it been filled with? What are the raw ingredients?
Well, a lot of it's been fruit and vegetable matter, but I just put some grass clippings and some shredded newspaper in there to balance it out a little bit, because it's been mostly like fruit and veggies.
Okay, grass clippings are the same as fruit and veggies.
Oh, it is, okay.
And is your lawn chemically treated?
Yes.
And then you can't use that compost.
Okay.
Because the herbicides that are used on American lawns are designed to kill any plant other than grass.
Okay.
So if you use that compost on fruits or vegetables or flowers, it could kill them.
Okay, even if you waited like a couple of weeks after the treatment? Okay, that's good to know.
Yes. Yeah, you don't want to. And when you cut your lawn, you should be using a recycling mower, a mulching mower that returns the spent clippings to your lawn.
Yes, I usually do that, yeah.
Especially if you're treating your lawn. That is the only safe use for those clippings.
Okay.
Now, to be perfectly honest, I would empty this composter out right now.
Okay.
And just dump the contents in the woods or something.
Okay.
When we get to the fall, when we start to get leaf fall, you know, get a leaf blower that has a reverse setting that sucks the leaves up and shreds them. That's the perfect brown material for your composting unit.
Okay.
You fill it up 3/4 with leaves, then you can mix in your kitchen waste as you go. I will tell you that the best kitchen waste you could have is coffee grounds.
Okay.
They add a lot. The other material, just chop it up as finely as you can, put it in there, and keep turning that thing. And then, whenever this thing processes compost, you keep turning it, you get the right mix of materials, you got some coffee grounds in there, you could get nicely finished compost perhaps in 6 weeks if it's in a warm area. And have lots of bags of shredded leaves handy to keep mixing in, to keep making fresh batches. The problem with newsprint is it doesn't have any nutrition in it. It's all been bleached out of it. And there are potential chemicals that were used in the bleaching process. So I hate to tell you this, but there's nothing of value in that liquid or in that composter. But if you start again, and this is very common, so don't feel bad. These are all mistakes that everybody makes.
Right.
But if you start with shredded leaves in the fall, and make sure you have a backlog of shredded leaves because they're the backbone of a composter, you can keep mixing in your kitchen waste with new batches of shredded leaves. With a system like what you have, you should be able to make a dozen batches of compost in a year.
Okay.
But there shouldn't have been that much liquid in there. That's kind of squirrely. So that meant that it was overwhelmed with green material. And I think you want to dump it out because it's probably going to start stinking pretty soon.
Oh, yeah. It was stinking when it came out.
Yes. Well, and that's a sign that there was too much nitrogen in there and you didn't have the leaves. What most people don't understand, the unfortunate truth, is that it's only really the fall leaves, the crushed up fall leaves, that become compost. The other stuff just fuels the process.
Oh, okay.
So if you don't want to deal with the leaves, if you just want to make compost from your fruit and vegetable waste, get a worm bin. Because then you do shred up newspaper for the bedding.
Oh, okay.
The worms process your waste into material that's better than compost, and there's always liquid coming out the spigot at the bottom that makes a great plant food.
Oh, okay.
All right.
I didn't know that. That's great to know.
All right, Matt?
Thank you so much.
Good luck, man.
Okay, thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the Delaware Center for Horticulture will celebrate the 30th anniversary of their annual City Gardens Contest by having gardeners cast the vote for a People's Choice Award after they tour the contending gardens on Saturday and Sunday, June 16th and 17th. And I'll reveal how to get your lawn off drugs on Sunday, June 24th at the Earth Fair at Burlington County, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do when Bermuda grass takes over your turf. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee offers seeds and live plants, edibles, flowers and perennials, treasured heirlooms, and high-performing hybrids. More information online at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY.
Food waste disposers grind up your food scraps and send them through the sewer system to Philadelphia's wastewater treatment plants, where they're converted into renewable energy and fertilizer. More information at philadelphiastreets.com. InSinkErator supports WHYY.
PNC Bank and the Barnes Foundation support WHYY and welcome visitors to the Barnes in Philadelphia to experience the vast collection of Picassos, Matisses, Renoirs, and Cezannes in their new home. For details on tickets and programs, barnesfoundation.org.
The Cooper Heart Valve Center supports WHYY. Aortic valve stenosis affects nearly 300,000 people annually. Cooper is the first hospital in South Jersey offering a new non-surgical valve repair, the Sapien Heart Valve. This FDA-approved technology offers a treatment option for patients unable to undergo valve surgery and is expected to transform the treatment of aortic valve disease. More at 800-8.
If you're looking for something that's
Cooper,
just plain...
Cooper or cooperhealth.org/sapien.
Sorry about that, Ed. If you're looking for something that's just plain fun, join WHYY on a trip to the English castle made famous by Downton Abbey. We're holding a wine and cheese reception June 14th to talk about this special trip. And to learn more, head to whyy.org/events.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, Bermuda grass is invading areas where it once couldn't survive winter. We'll explain why this is happening and what you can do about it when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a fabulous phone call show, cats and kittens. You know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Corey, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, Corey. How are you?
Doing great, thank you.
And where is Corey great?
We are in Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania. It's about 20 or 30 minutes outside of Philadelphia.
Very good. What can we do for Corey in Lafayette Hill?
Well, we have a 2-year-old son and another one on the way in July. He loves to play outside, and we've already run into quite a few problems with mosquitoes in the backyard. He's been bit quite a few times, and looking for some natural ways to keep the mosquitoes away with mosquito-repellent plants.
Well, I got good news, and I got bad news.
Okay.
Which would you like?
Oh, give me the bad news first.
The bad news is that no plant just sitting in the ground can repel mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah. Hmm.
The way that mosquito-repelling plants work, and they work brilliantly, is that you grow the plants, and then when you send your child outside to blow the stink off themselves and play outdoors, you take a big handful of the leaves, and you crush them up, and you rub them over every area of the exposed skin.
Okay.
That's how mosquito-repelling plants work. And in that case, studies have shown them to be very effective as some formulations of DEET.
Right.
But not just growing in the ground. To limit the number of mosquitoes on your property, obviously you know about no standing water anywhere. You have to be really vigilant. I mean, it's horrifying. If you drop a cat food can out of the recycling on the way to the curb and it lands head up and it gets filled with water, that little can, which could be hidden by tall grass in a couple of days, can breed thousands of mosquitoes throughout the summer season. So you really need to go on a search and destroy mission. You have to make sure outdoor play equipment and stuff like that doesn't collect water. And you need to check your gutters every spring. Gutters get clogged up. They are supreme mosquito breeding sites. And because they are out of sight, they often go unthought of.
Wow.
So the plants that you would be interested in, the perennial is lemon balm, B-A-L-M, which is a member of the mint family and spreads aggressively. Yes, and it forms big plants and it spreads a lot. Now, I quote-unquote kill all my lemon balm at the end of the season. I pull it all up and I cut it back. And the following spring, I have plenty of lemon balm come back up. The other plants that are very effective when crushed and rubbed on the skin are catnip and lemon thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, lemon-scented thyme, which could be a perennial where you live. It's technically an annual, but mine has often survived over mild winters. The issue with lemon thyme, it is the single most effective plant against mosquitoes when crushed and rubbed on the skin, but it doesn't produce enormous amounts of leaves, and the leaves tend to be small.
Right.
So I wish there was a plant you could grow that would keep mosquitoes away, but no such luck. Break their breeding sites and rub lemon-scented herbs or catnip on their skin.
Okay, excellent. That's a great help. Sounds a lot better to rub plant crushed up plants than to spray bug spray or DEET, and I just want to keep that away from him as much as possible. So this is a great solution.
You never want to put DEET on a child because one of the issues with DEET is it's absorbed through the skin. It doesn't dissipate off your skin. It doesn't air gas. It goes through your kidneys and liver.
Well, thank you very much for all your insight.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, Mike, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be able to talk with you. And my wife, Kimberly, and I really appreciate the effort you put into educating the public on sound gardening practices.
Why, thank you, Dave.
The reason that I'm calling is that I have a cousin who permanently resides in the UK, but also has a home just outside of Pisa, Italy. And when he visited us here, my wife wowed him with her knowledge about native Maryland plants. And when he returned home to Pisa, he noticed a major problem with his peach tree. He emailed us the question, but since fruit trees aren't really our expertise, we figured, why not go to the best source we know, and that's you. So if you have a moment, I'd like to read you exactly what he wrote me, and perhaps you have an answer for us.
Yes. Now, Dave, the peach tree in question is in Italy.
That's correct.
The gardener's in England.
That's correct.
I'm in Philadelphia. Where are you?
I'm in Timonium, Maryland.
boy, we got all four bases covered. All right, proceed.
Right. I'll quote him. When I got back from the U.S./UK, my two-year-old tree had clearly succumbed to some disease infestation. Apart from the speckled red dots, the fruits were developing, so all I did was give it a copper-based spray and an insecticide spray, too. This was about 3 weeks ago. All of a sudden, it got worse, and this morning the fruits have now shriveled up, and it's looking really sick. Looking at photos on the web, I don't think it's classic peach leaf curl disease, but I'm not sure what it is. Any help is appreciated. Kind regards, Paul Forte.
Well, the red dots, and I bet the leaves had taken on a flame-like color along with those red dots. That's a classic sign of fire blight, which is unfortunately very common disease on peach trees. And I tell you, I grow 8 peach trees for my wife, and it has been a very humbling experience. We don't know what kind of care they've been giving the trees. But as I've learned the hard way over the years, the trees have to be pruned every year. Peach trees especially have this tendency to put on enormous amounts of lush growth. And of course, when it's damp out, that lush growth blocks any kind of sunlight, blocks any kind of airflow, and gives disease a great place to get a foothold. So peach trees and apple trees as well, but especially peaches, need to be really heavily pruned every year, somewhere between the end of winter and when the trees are in flower. You know, in pruning books, they use this expression, remove crossing branches. In fruit
right.
trees, it's not an expression. You know, you're not going to get any fruit if you don't make that tree look really open. You're removing like 75% of the fruits, and it's heartbreaking. But this is the path to preventing disease before it starts. I would also have them go back in a time machine when they pick this variety of peach and ask mm-hmm. them, did they ask about the disease resistance? You know, some trees are naturally resistant, some trees are more susceptible. Is it planted out in the open where it gets morning sun, where it gets good airflow? These things are all essential. And then copper is a very old school fungicide. You never spray insecticides without knowing what you're doing. There are organic insecticides that can control any pests, but you never spray an insecticide randomly. All you can do is kill pollinators and beneficial insects at that point. But there are two products that are available in the States that are magnificent at naturally preventing disease. One is known by the brand name Serenade. And Serenade is actually a living soil organism called Bacillus subtilis. It sounds like an old cartoon name or something.
Really?
And it's available under a lot of brand names, but it's like Tylenol. Everybody knows it as Serenade.
Okay.
And that's an excellent disease preventative.
Okay.
But, you know, if you know this is going to be a problem, if you know your tree is prone or if you've had a cool, wet spring, you start spraying it before any blight shows up, before any signs of disease show up. Although the correct pruning and fruit thinning will dramatically reduce the possibility of anything like that showing up. The other is a product that may well be available in Europe, as may well Serenade, called Surround, which is a clay spray that after the fruits have begun to be formed, you spray the whole tree with this kaolin clay that's very finely milled, and it mixes with water, and it coats the entire tree. And it's a physical barrier against insects and disease. Make sure the tree gets good airflow, good morning sun, and they do the fruit thinning. That is the best prevention against fire blight or peach leaf curl, which was a good guess.
And then, so in terms of what he could do now...
There's nothing that can be done for the tree this year. Okay? It's not going to reflower. It's not going to refruit, even though it is in Italy. If it could ever happen, it would happen in Italy.
That's
no.
Right.
He has to just make sure he removes all the diseased parts from the orchard. He has to do a great cleanup of the orchard floor at the end of the season. All the leaves that drop off, any mummified fruits, they all have to be taken away and destroyed. And then it would be very smart to spread yard waste compost on top of the ground underneath the tree.
Right, right. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to answer these questions.
Thank you, Dave. Good luck, man.
All right, thanks. Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Ruth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, thank you very much for making it. Ruth, may I ask where you are?
I'm in Traverse City, Michigan.
We love our listeners in Traverse City. That was one of the first stations to pick us up many, many years ago. We love our Michigan listeners. What can
we
do for you?
There's a lot to love about Traverse City. Well, one problem that we have here is marauding deer, even in town. And just before the tulips in a flower bed in my front yard bloomed, they were so close to bloom that I could tell what color each was going to be, the deer came through the subdivision, and they ate the tulips, bud, leaf, and all.
Oh.
I had already scheduled someone to come and reseed the front yard, so I took that flower bed out, and I now have a shoebox full of tulip bulbs, and I have no idea what to do with them this time of year. Can you help me?
Well, in the future, what you want to do when your tulips first break ground in a situation like yours, and there are very few places in the country that don't have marauding deer, and it is not unusual to see them in town. In Philadelphia, for instance, they use the subway system. They have transpasses. They can get on the buses if they need to make a long trip across town because they've eaten all the tulips in North Philadelphia and they're going to South
Philly. Well,
they're
just a bit more educated than our deer.
What you want to do, as soon as your tulips break down, tulips or crocus, you want to have a deer repellent handy and you want to spray it on them. You want to spray it on them after it rains, and you want to spray it on them no matter what, about every 10 days. Because the whole process won't take that long. But that's the only way you're going to see those blooms. The problem with tulips is they are not only edible, they are incredibly nutritious and very tasty. So it's not just deer. Voles, squirrels,
I know. I've had enough trouble with squirrels, too.
Everything likes to eat tulips. We could eat tulips. The Dutch ate some of their tulip bulbs during the Nazi embargo of World War II. So they're,
I didn't know that.
They're entirely edible and apparently very tasty. So the question becomes, your flowers were about to bloom, but all of the greenery was eaten?
Yes.
Typically what happens is after a tulip blooms, then the greenery that exists absorbs the solar energy to grow another bulb.
That's the predicament.
So
I saw.
Here's what's going to happen. You may store these over the summer. You are more than welcome to replant them somewhere in the fall. As long as the bulbs are sound, that is, they're nice and firm, they feel like an onion that you'd buy in a store, no soft spots or anything like that, you can replant them in the fall, and they will leaf out in the spring. They will probably not bloom. Maybe one or two of them will bloom, but it would not be surprising to see no blooms. This would be an in-between year. You could, for instance, grow them in a container somehow, although in your area that would be very tricky because the winters are so cold. But you could grow them in an out-of-the-way area, and you could protect them physically with some fencing or some rabbit wire pulled across them. Leave their green leaves alone until the leaves turn brown, And then, whether you leave them in that spot or after you, after they turn brown, you're very welcome to dig them up and store them over the summer. That's what I do with all my tulip bulbs. And then you would replant them in the fall the following year. They would bloom again.
Is there a certain way I need to store them through the summer? Or do I just need to keep them dry and somewhat cool?
Dry and cool is almost everything. What I do is I take a big plant pot, just a regular plastic plant pot with drainage holes in the bottom.
Yes.
And I'll toss in some soil-free mix or some milled peat moss. Then I'll do a layer of bulbs, then more of the same, then another layer of bulbs until I get to the top. And then I'll just pull a piece of screening over top and affix that with a rubber band or something to make sure it stays in place so mice or squirrels don't get into the pot over the summertime. And then in the fall, after Halloween, I replant them.
Well, thank you. I had no idea what to do, and I appreciate the information very much.
My pleasure, Ruth. Thank you. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the 15th Annual Woody Plant Conference will be held Wednesday, July 25th at Villanova University. And Holly Shimizu, Executive Director of the U.S. Botanic Garden, will deliver the keynote at the American Horticultural Society's 20th Annual Children and Youth Garden Symposium at the University of Maryland's College Park campus, July 19th through the 21st. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and a trip to Bermuda that no lawn owner seems to want. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee has been providing gardeners with seeds, plants, and supplies for growing everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs for over a century. More information online at burpee.com.
There's more of You Bet Your Garden straight ahead on WHYY.
The Princeton Festival supports WHYY. Running June 9th through the 30th, the Princeton Festival features performances of dance, jazz, opera, musical theater, chamber music, cabaret, and more. The sounds of Indonesia from Gamelan Dharmaswara, Latin jazz with the Rodriguez brothers, and the musical Once Upon a Mattress are among the many showcase performances. More information at PrincetonFestival.org.
Hey, students. The WHYY Young Journalist Summer Camp provides hands-on multimedia journalism experience for teens. Sessions are available in June and August, and you can register today at WHYY.org/camps. Temperature 82 degrees in Center City.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Why is Bermuda grass extending its range further north than it ever did? Why is it proving so tenacious to remove? And what can you do if it invades your turf? We'll have the answers to all those questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Henry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing? I love your show. I listen to it every Saturday. I have a question about straw. I use that as a mulch around my tomatoes and peppers. And the other day I was doing it, and I was wondering, am I doing some harm because I didn't know how the straw is grown? Are pesticides or herbicides used when they grow straw? And if so, can that be contaminating the soil beneath my tomatoes?
Well, this is one of the oldest questions in organic gardening. And Henry, may I ask where you are?
I'm in Ambler, PA.
Okay, very good. This is an issue with barnyard manures. You know, a lot of people are in love with the idea of using composted horse manure or composted poultry manure. The manures were typically taken from animals that were, you know, treated the way we treat most of our food, sometimes from animals in confinement. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with straw. If the straw was typically grown for animal fodder, and if it's true straw, all the seed heads are removed. The seed heads are used for animal food or sometimes even human food. And then the bulk of the material with the seed heads removed, which is now hollow like a drinking straw, is sold for all sorts of agricultural and decorative uses. What would Halloween be without giant straw bales sitting around and, you know, lining the sides of rides and things like that? So more than likely, unless you are lucky enough to find an organic farm that sells their straw, it will have been grown conventionally. But there comes a time when you must make peace, at least in the way I believe this, is you have to make peace with the world after a certain point. Straw is dried. It has been around a while. Anything that was once liquid on it has evaporated. Once it's spread out in your garden, rather than contaminate the soil, the odds are that the sun and the air will continue to cook any contaminants out of it. So it almost comes down to a risk thing. What is the risk of using material that is, by definition, kind of aged, which is going to reduce the level of contaminants, versus, for instance, if you were to spray anything chemical in your garden? To me, you'd be increasing the risk a hundredfold,
whereby
this is a minimal risk. And after a point, you can back yourself into a corner. One of the things I try to be careful about is, since I'm always telling people not to use any agricultural chemicals, I've always had the position that I need to lighten up about things like peat moss and straw and composted manures, because you can't just say no to anything.
Right.
I've used straw in my own garden, for instance.
Now, I noticed that when I used the straw mulch a couple of years ago, I had a much lower incidence of blight and black spot on my tomatoes. And I thought maybe I was isolating the soil spores from the plants.
Yes, you were.
And that was a good thing.
Yes, you were.
And I know you have to have air around your plant as well.
Well, that's where straw is one of the best, right?
Right, right.
Because straw gives you this great air circulation and a physical barrier.
Right.
Not an easy combination to achieve.
I also purchased what they call an organic fungicide. It's made with rosemary oil and primrose oil and water, and I was wondering, and mineral oil. And they say it's an organic fungicide, but I wonder, is it truly okay to put on vegetables that you're going to eat?
Oh, I think, something that uses the essential oil of rosemary as a main ingredient. I mean, I eat rosemary.
Yeah, oh, sure.
So I would not have a lot of confidence in it as a fungicide.
That's my question. Right.
If you want a spray that is a very effective fungicide, I would instead make the Cornell formula, which is a baking soda and oil spray. If you go to our website and go to Garden Answers A to Z, you'll find that under C for Cornell. And especially under R for roses. A lot of rose growers rely on the Cornell formula. And sprays of compost tea directly on the plants in the morning.
And that could be used on tomatoes too, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
And you would spray the upper and lower surface of the leaf.
It's the lower surface of the leaves that are the most important.
Right.
Yeah, all disease starts on the bottom of the leaf.
Didn't know that. Okay, Mike.
All right, Henry, thank you.
Thank you so much for answering my questions. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Marshall, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Marshall. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for asking.
And where is Marshall great?
I am in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is in southern New Mexico.
Okay, so you have a very warm climate down there with very little bit of a winter, right?
Yes, sir, and it's sunny every day.
Yeah. So what can we do for you, Marsh?
Well, it's my first garden, and I kind of read the directions on most of the plants I put in, but I, as a typical guy, I just kind of, like, didn't fully read the directions, so I overplanted terribly. But my zucchinis, I have maybe, like, an 8-foot row, and there's, like, 5 or 6 plants in there that are maybe 4 feet tall at least.
Uh-huh.
I have green beans that are out of control. I have tomatoes that are out of control. I have my cucumbers. You know, I wanted cucumbers, so I have maybe a 5-foot row, and there's maybe a dozen plants at least in there, all growing, healthy. But I don't know if I should pull them, if they're going to outcompete each other. You know, I want to make sure that everything's happy and healthy and not, you know, kind of sickly.
raised bed or flat ground?
Most of them are in flat ground, I guess, at this point.
And what is giving them nutrition?
Well, I water them just about every night with a drip, and then when I tilled the soil, I got some fertilizer from the city. It was just from the solid waste facility, and I just mixed a little bit of that in with the soil, so that's where they're getting most of their nutrition.
Okay.
And of course, the sun.
I would advise you against using biosolids again in the future. It's treated human waste, which...
Right, I know.
Well, it's not that. There's nothing wrong with what enthusiasts call our humanure, but criminals pour things down the sewers, chemicals get into the drains, and unfortunately, humans are over-medicated, and a lot of the medications are surviving the treatment process, so there are probably measurable levels of antidepressants and antibiotics especially. It's controversial. Some people don't mind using it. I would rather you find a better source of compost, real yard waste compost or a balanced organic fertilizer. Switch your drip irrigation to come on in the morning, not in the evening. And you should really be saturating that soil two or three times a week. You shouldn't be watering every day. And you shouldn't be watering at night, although watering at the root zone at night is not nearly as bad as wetting the leaves at night, and you're in a very dry and non-humid environment. So the plants will absorb and utilize the water better in the morning because that's when they're used to getting it. And they would prefer to have that on for like an hour and a half, two or three times a week. You do want to let them dry out between waterings.
Yeah.
There's not enough food there. So are the plants pushing against each other and making it hard to see the different lines where they would be delineated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the zucchinis are just like one gigantic mass of zucchinis now.
And do you have any outlet for all this extra produce?
Yeah, we're splitting the garden between us. We live in a split-side duplex, so we're splitting it with our neighbor. And then we're giving some to the landlord, right, to offset the use of the garden
and
the water.
If you lived in a normal climate, I would be worried about disease from the plants being that crowded. But your humidity levels are naturally extremely low, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, it's like 20%.
Yeah, so you need a nice mulch on top of the soil to actually keep that moisture in the soil as well. What I would like you to do after we're done talking is go to our website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on Garden Answers A to Z. Read a few of the fertilizing and mulch questions. They'll hold your hand and you'll get the right things. You know, the honest answer, you need to remove every other plant in the fruiting plant category. That would be the zucchinis, the cukes, the tomatoes. Although, with your dry environment, if they don't show any signs of disease and they're producing, you can have a lighter hand. But if you can remove a few of them, or if you can get some help with the harvest and maybe donate the extras to a food bank, but you're going to hit a wall pretty soon with the lack of nutrition in the soil. You got to get some fertilizer. I would prefer compost, but there's some good organic fertilizers you can buy. My advice to you is you really do need to get some harvesting help, and your local food bank would probably be glad to have people come out in the morning or the evening and pick and take away some of your extras for fresh local produce.
We can do that.
All right, man?
All right, thank you.
Good luck, Marshall. All right, as promised, it's time for our question of the week. Why is Bermuda grass taking over the transition zone? Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, read off this week's questions, if you please.
Well, Kathy in Gaithersburg, Maryland writes, "Help! How can I get rid of Bermuda grass permanently? Last year, we killed our Bermuda-infested lawn with Roundup, left it alone over the winter, and then tilled it up and planted new seed this spring. But the Bermuda is back and spreading again. What can we do?" We also heard from David in Sterling, Virginia, who writes, Bermuda has completely taken over the yard on one side of our house, the side that gets less sun. It looks pretty at times when seen from a distance, but I wouldn't call it a lawn grass. How can I get rid of it and keep it from coming back? And finally, Robert in Woodbridge, Virginia writes, how do I rid my lawn of Bermuda grass? Moving is not an option.
Well, it's no coincidence that all of our questioners live in the Washington, D.C. area, which our lawn care expert, Dr. Nick Christians of Iowa State University, explains is a region that pretty much defines the transition zone. Now, as we often explain, two basic types of lawn grasses are used in the United States. Cool season grasses like fescue, rye, and bluegrass that thrive when temperatures are normal to cool, but that are greatly stressed by summer heat. And warm season grasses like centipede, Bermuda, St. Augustine, and zoysia that thrive in summer heat but die off or go dormant in winter. So that's easy, right? Use a cool season grass in the north, warm in the south. Ah, but the brightly colored maps that illustrate each region's preferred turf type have a dark shadow called the transition zone that hovers over a large swath of the nation. Roughly from the bottom of Pennsylvania, down to the Carolinas, and west to include all of Oklahoma and most of Kansas. Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, and the Virginias are all 100% trapped inside the zone, where the summers are too hot for cool season grasses and the winters too cold for warm season grasses. Nick explains that homeowners in the transition zone have to choose the lesser of two evils, either a grass that's green in the winter but is very much at risk of burning up in the summer, or a turf that thrives in summer but goes tan and dormant over the winter. At least that was traditionally the choice. Nick adds that whatever the cause, our average temperatures are definitely increasing, making it difficult to maintain a cool season grass over the summer in the transition zone. But Bermuda grass loves a hot summer, and it's been deliberately planted in the D.C. area over the years so it can pop up almost anywhere. I thought the D.C. winters were too cold for Bermuda grass. It won't survive winter a lot further north, explains Nick. Zoysia is the only warm season grass that can survive in the upper tier of the country. But Bermuda is perennial in most parts of the transition zone. And he adds it's a very aggressive grass. It spreads rapidly. It tolerates shade very well. And it can come up on the other side of a 12-inch deep barrier. And many homeowners in the transition zone make it easier for warm season grasses to move in by caring for their cool season lawns incorrectly in summer. If you want a cool season grass to be able to even try and compete with an invader like Bermuda, it should never be cut below 3 inches. It should be fed only in the spring and fall, never in the summer, and should only be watered deeply and infrequently. Cut it too short, shock it with fertilizer when it's already heat-stressed, and or water it for short periods of time frequently, and your cool-season grass won't have a chance. Ah, but warm-season grasses will thrive with summer feedings in that short cut. So what's a lawn owner with invading Bermuda to do? Make peace with it, says Nick. Yes, it goes dormant over the winter, just like zoysia, but the more the climate heats up, the more it becomes the successful grass in the transition zone. If you don't like the type or texture of the Bermuda that's taking over your lawn, tear it up and replace it with an improved variety of Bermuda next spring. Nick stresses that the time of year any kind of lawn is installed is crucial. Warm season grasses are best installed in the spring. Cool season grasses in the fall. That's one reason the Bermuda grass came back so quickly on the people who said they tore up and replanted their lawn. They specified that they sowed new cool season grass seed in the spring, and that rarely works, especially if there's any Bermuda left in the soil. To try and install a new cool season lawn, Nick explains that you'd first have to have the old turf chemically sterilized to kill the Bermuda, which costs a fortune, must be done by a licensed professional, as Nick puts it, uses the kind of chemicals that I've been railing against for decades, and it ignores the fact that the climate is greatly favoring warm season grasses in these regions. Even when people don't mind using herbicides, I strongly advise going with a warm season grass in these situations, concludes Nick. Because no matter what you do, in the long run, my money's on the Bermuda. Well, that sure was some tough news for those who don't want their yard to cruise to Bermuda now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to change my climate if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your charge, your poor, your wretched refuse team towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check voice to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. Bermuda-loving Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Kelly Haggerty, says that she's up for a trip to the islands. Already grabbing swim fins is our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm more of a Wildwood boardwalk kind of guy, Mike McGrath, but I'll skip the trip to Max Pizza so I can see you next week. They look like little caterpillars or slugs, but leaf-chewing sawflies are actually baby wasps. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to protect your roses and other plants from this unusual foe, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike's magniloquent magic means magnificent marjoram, magnolia, myrtle. Join us for You Bet Your Garden Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY.
The Arden Theater supports WHYY and presents Tulipomania, the musical, at the Arden Theater May 24th through July 1st. From Michael Ogborn, the writer and composer of Cafe Putanesca and Baby Case, comes a new musical that gets high off our financial lows. Before the subprime mortgage crisis, Holland had the tulip bulb bubble. Six strangers in an Amsterdam hash bar recall this seedy story of love, sex, money, and power. Details online at ardentheater.org or 215 92